Hello and welcome to another Folklore Podcast special feature. This is the third of the three interviews that I recorded at the UK Ghost Story Festival in Derby earlier in the year. In this one, I chat with author Lauren McMenemy, who was also one of the assistants helping to organise aspects of the Ghost Story Festival. Enjoy the chat. So here we are with another UK Ghost Story Festival Folklore Podcast special featurette. Mm-hmm. I just made that up. That sounds great.
It's wonderful.
Joining me this time is the lovely Lauren McMenemy.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hello. Hello. What is your involvement with the UK Ghost Story Festival?
So with this festival, I have been helping out behind the scenes a little bit. When Alex said that he was putting this on again, I wanted to be involved. I was an attendee at the last one that he did here in Derby just over a year ago. Absolutely loved it, and it was part of my reintroduction to the world post-COVID.
Yes.
Really, actually my first writing event as well as a writer.
Excellent.
So I said, I loved it, I want to be involved.
So tell me a little bit about your background then leading you up to wanting to be involved with this and your writing. What is your background and how does your writing fit into that?
And who the hell am I?
Yes, that's the kind of thing.
Sure. So my name is Lauren McMenemy. I am a writer of Gothic and folk horror. I'm also the editor of HorrorTree.com's Trembling with Fear, which is a weekly zine where we publish short stories and drabbles, which are stories of exactly 100 words. Very much leaning into the darkness of speculative fiction there. I have always wanted to be a writer. I was that kid who was writing books and drawing my own covers and thrusting them into the hands of visitors. But I was encouraged quite young to think of that as a hobby because it would never make me money. It would never be a way to make a living. So I ended up going into journalism. And I was a journalist back home in Adelaide, South Australia, for 7 years, working for Mr. Murdoch's empire, because he owns everything over there, and I can tell you Succession is pretty much a documentary with the names changed. So I was a journalist, and then I moved over to the UK in the mid-2000s and started working in marketing. So I have a lot of experience in that sort of writing, copywriting, content writing, articles, blogs, social media, etc. But then the little niggle of, you wanted to create fiction, why are you writing other people's stories, just kept tapping away. So I did start, about 10 years ago, started entering writing competitions and really exploring what I wanted to do. And horror writing actually just kept coming back. Every time I did a competition connected with horror, I did really well in it. And I thought, well, that's telling me something. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, back in the day, I was the kid reading all the point horror books and the Stephen King books at the age of 10 and all of that. But it's also something I'd gone away from because it wasn't socially acceptable. So, the last decade has been me reclaiming my otherness, my interest in the dark side, in the occult. So this is a perfect merging of my two worlds. I can help out with the marketing, with the social media, the promotion. If you've been following the Ghost Story Festival on Instagram, all the little graphics is me tinkering around on Canva. Mm-hmm. But it also led me to be part of the festival. I've run a couple of workshops here and also done the interviews with Emma Stonex about the Lamplighters and CJ Cook about her latest, The Ghostwoods.
Yes, yes, excellent. Now, we'll talk a little bit about what you're writing and those sorts of things in a minute. Just a quick diversion. You say you moved to the UK in the mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. Now, you were saying before we started recording that you lived in the Australian kind of weird crime serial killer capital of the world.
Yes.
What does that mean, and was that why you moved to the UK?
I wasn't a victim of any of these crimes, so no, it's not
or
the reason.
Or a perpetrator.
That is never been proven.
Okay.
But I'm from Adelaide in South Australia, and it is known, certainly around Australia, as the place that the weirdest serial killers and strange violent crimes happen. So for the listeners who might have heard of the Snowtown killings, that was just outside of Adelaide. Also, definitely people who are into folklore and mystery will have heard of the Somerton Man. That was in Adelaide in the 1940s.
Is there actually, do you think, a reason for that, or is it pure coincidence?
It's really interesting. So Adelaide, if you think of the geography of Australia, you've got the west coast, which is Perth, where so many people in the UK have family that have moved to Perth. So you've got that's on the west coast. Then you've got the east coast, which is the places everyone's heard of. Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, the Gold Coast, all of that sort of thing. Adelaide's in the middle. It's in the middle down the bottom, so it's not even like Darwin and Alice Springs and all of the, you know, the really crazy places. So it's kind of a little bit forgotten. But the history of South Australia is, you know, we are very proud of the fact that we were the only non-convict settlement in Australia. So there's a little bit of parochialism that goes on over there. But people who live in Adelaide, and especially grew up in Adelaide, I mean, I grew up in Adelaide in the 80s. I was born in the late 70s. So I was very much in the 80s and 90s growing up. And the whole state went bankrupt. So there wasn't much happening. There was a lot of brain drain going to the east states, going overseas. There was just a bit of a really strange atmosphere. And for those who grew up around there, you know, we had some mysterious pedophile rings going on. And it was really in the consciousness as well. Like this is the place where people just disappear. So it's just something that Adelaideans know about. And I've actually got one of my good friends back home who started at the newspaper with me at the same time. He's a crime reporter, and he's written and done podcasts on the true crime of South Australia because it is so strange. So yeah, if you look up, his name's Sean Fuster. If you look him up, you'll find it probably a lot more detailed than I can give you.
I do like the irony of the fact that all the strange crime happens in the only non-convict settled part of Australia.
Yeah, well, it was a free settlement. It's also known, ironically, as the City of Churches because there was freedom of religion. It is one of the first places in the world, I think New Zealand might have just pipped us, one of the first places in the world to give women the vote. Even when women were given the vote, the Aboriginal population was given the vote, which was unheard of. So there is a lot of, you know, for a long time, Adelaide was the, South Australia was the free state. But then, as I say, in the sort of 80s, it just dropped down. It became quite conservative. It became quite closeted, quite, you know, something weird in the air. I mean, we have strange crime going back all the way down. You know, like I say, Somerton Man was the 40s. There were children, the Beaumont children went missing, I think, in the 70s, and no one knows what's happened to them. Every few years, there's a news story, oh, we think the Beaumont children might be buried in this basement somewhere underneath the concrete. So you're always aware of the strange things that have happened, but you're never really sure why.
Yeah.
And I kind of think it's because it's a bit of the forgotten state, because it's not got the population of the East Coast. It's not got the isolation of the West Coast. You know, Perth is one of the most isolated cities in the world, so it's made its own culture. SA and Adelaide in particular are just kind of there. Gorgeous, really beautiful, but just kind of there. And no one really thinks about it.
This has just triggered an interesting thought, actually, because I had an email a couple of days ago from somebody who was asking me if I would like to do an interview with them about the Pennsylvanian Dutch powwow. So this is essentially ritual magic and folk remedy in the Pennsylvania Dutch tradition. And why it made me think of that, and I think this will be a future episode of the podcast because I think it'd be really interesting, but what it made me think of that is that Pennsylvania was one of those states with the freedom of religious settlement, which led to all of this folk remedy and superstitious magic and ritual curative material coming in and settling and forming this amalgam of what is now folklore. And it sounds like that's a similar sort of thing, actually.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's a very multicultural, multi-faith kind of place. And a lot of that intermingling as well does come up with some really interesting stories from the past. I mean, my novel that I've since put aside because I couldn't quite make it work, but I knew it had to be set in South Australia because I wanted to really explore like a folk horror around the role of a woman in her 40s if she's not a mother. And I was like, well, the obvious place to do that is in a really strange enclave in just off what's called the Oodnadatta Track, which is, it was actually a trade thoroughfare for the Aboriginal tribes. So it was just this really remote place that just felt right for folk horror. More flies than people, that sort of place. And the connection to the land as well is so important there too.
Yeah, it is. Okay, let's talk about your writing. You say about that novel that you've put aside. Let's not talk about that one. Let's talk about what you are working on. What themes are you working with that you're happy to discuss with an in development project?
It is definitely very early in development, this one. Over lockdowns, I got in the habit of joining a lot of online lectures. Many of yours were one of them. I was very much a rural Gothic girl.
Yeah.
But I attended a lecture about someone who was a spiritual guru in the late Victorian period. And I just got so incensed about the way she was being described.
Mm.
There was a lot of focus on her looks. It's like, well, she was fat and ugly, so she must have been, you know, actually a cult, because else would anyone listen to her? And I felt, and this is, you know, me sounding spooky, I felt her tapping my shoulder constantly, going, this is bull dust, like, why are they saying this? This is ridiculous. Yeah. I couldn't let it go. So I ended up getting a few biographies of this person and found out that she was subject to an investigation by the Society for Psychical Research. In their early days, when they were really trying to make their name, this person was in the media a lot. She very much courted media attention, so they thought, oh, we'll use her to look into spiritualism, mysterious appearances, is she talking on the astral plane, all of these sorts of things. And there was an investigation into her, and she was declared a fraud, and it pretty much ruined her life. She was really unwell, and then she died. But about 100 years later, the SPR, which is still a going concern for those who don't know, the SPR reopened the investigation on its 100th birthday and actually declared that the investigation was incredibly biased and it was a missed opportunity. And that, the writer in me just went, oh my goodness. So I have spent the last year reading up on just various things, not like dedicated time, because, you know, I was, you know, going through some health issues and whatever, but this was always at the back of my mind. It's like, oh, there's another thing. Okay. And I just started grabbing. And towards the end of last year, I thought, okay, yeah, it's time now. So I've, you know, been working out how I can tell her story in a way that maintains her enigma and doesn't actually offer any answers. So that is what I'm currently working on.
So any plans for this in terms of time scale, do you think? You say it's in the early stages of development, which makes that a very difficult question to
ask. It is a very difficult question to ask, but I'm also incredibly impatient.
Okay.
So having started my writing career as a journalist, I do tend to write fast. So I know when I'm ready to start, it will come out fast.
Right.
It's just a matter of sitting down and actually doing that. But I have, I've got a plan. My intention is to write the first draft, I'm going to say, here before the end of the summer.
Okay.
Hold me to it, please.
I can. It's recorded now.
It's recorded now. It's out there for posterity. But I really want to get this ready this year so I can start querying and getting it out there. Because, like I say, I'm impatient, but she also taps on my shoulder all the time. She's like, why haven't you done this yet? Like, everyone's just out there calling me fat and ugly, and that's not fair. I think there's a lot of potential in this story.
I agree. I am already intrigued by the possibilities of this. So, yes, I shall be contacting you in the summer to make sure that you've reached that stage. And if you haven't, I shall want to know why.
Okay, so I shall report,
Be prepared. We've heard a lot of material over the course of this weekend about ghost stories and associated genres from a number of authors and other presenters. And it's a genre that's still immensely popular, I think. And I've spoken to a couple of other people over the weekend about this same thing. I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked them, which is, why do you think that is the case? What is it about the ghost story as a genre that appeals to us?
I think there's a lot there, really, and the ghost story can take many, many forms as well. So it really depends on what sort of ghost story you're looking at. For me, we're all haunted by something. You know, even people who have had the most pleasant lives imaginable have something that haunts them. And I think it's that haunting that the ghost represents, that sort of maybe that regret, that mistake, that thing you wished you'd done, or that person from your life, that experience that you were trying to get away from but you haven't processed yet. I think that is what really draws us to the ghost story. But also in the more practical sense, I mean, the ghost represents the afterlife. And death is the biggest fear out there. It is the biggest mystery out there. What happens? And I know, you know, having been involved in a lot of the pre-marketing for this festival, the minute you ask anyone about why are we so interested in ghost stories, the first thing they say is, well, it's about life after death, isn't it? And I think that really is it. You know, it's a sort of mystery that's never going to go away, you know, unless some scientist comes along and can prove to us that there is life after death. That's the SPR, we're trying to investigate it in the Victorian era, we still haven't figured it out. So I think that's really why the ghost story is. And especially you find, you know, it's always bubbling away under the surface, but you find a real rise in ghost stories, and especially in Gothic, when the world goes to a bit of a mess, and we have not been in the nicest state of living for the last few years, arguably the last few decades, you know, really. And so we do start pondering some of those more mysteries of life.
And
I think that's why it's coming back.
We do, and I think the longevity of this actually is because it comes down to faith at the end of the day. Now, the beauty of folklore is that we're not interested in that aspect of truth. It doesn't matter whether the afterlife exists or doesn't exist to us as folklorists. We're more interested in that whole belief system, why people think it does or it doesn't. Now, for anybody who believes that ghosts are spirits of those that have passed on, no amount of scientific proof to the contrary will change that view.
Absolutely.
But equally, to the scientist who absolutely doesn't believe that that's the case, no amount of evidential experience in terms of other means of showing it will prove the other way as well. So I don't think that mystery will ever go away one way or the other.
And I mean, I've mentioned the SPR a few times now, but I think that's what is so fascinating to me about that period. You know, I never considered myself a historical novelist, but just that period where you've got the rise of science, the start of the fall of religion, but there was still, there was that space in between, that liminal space when people had questions that they wanted to put the scientific rigor to, the mysteries that you can't really put scientific rigor to.
Yeah.
And I think it is that space that is just so fascinating to me, for sure.
Liminal is a word that's come up a lot over the course of the weekend.
I'm sure.
It comes up all the time, of course, in terms of folklore as well. That boundary state is really important. So, yeah, you're right. Okay, finally, let's just talk a little bit about recommendations, because we are at a festival which is predominantly authors, both presenting, and actually a number of the attendees as well are writers who are not presenting but are here to network or to hear more from other authors and that. So what's on a recommended reading list in the genre from you at the moment? And that can be modern literature, but can equally be M.R. James. We'll just get that in there now because it comes up every time, you know. So,
yeah.
Historical fiction or modern fiction. Or, to quote Camilla Bruce, who I spoke to earlier on, who works in that genre, speculative fiction, which also fits into that as well.
Yeah, and that's what we call it at Horrortry as well, as it's speculative fiction. I'm going to leave the older stuff because I'm sure you've had a load of recommendations, as you say, M.R. James, Shirley Jackson, whatever it might be. I'm going to maybe make some recommendations about writers that have been at this festival.
Yeah, good plan.
It would be remiss of me not to recommend the two women who I interviewed. Emma Stonex's The Lamplighters is absolutely gorgeous. It's about, it's actually inspired by a real life disappearance on a lighthouse off the coast of Scotland. But she's brought it to the 1970s. She's looking at a tower lighthouse, which is the ones that are like right out in the middle of the ocean, just based on a rock, where the three lighthousemen disappear, just completely disappear. It's a bit of a locked room mystery. But she's not only looking at that disappearance, she's also looking at the effect on those who are left behind. Mm. So she's got the wives' points of view in there as well. As from a writing point of view, it's really interesting in how she's tackled that. She's got lots of multiple points of view, lots of different narrative styles as well. But as a story, it's just absolutely beautiful and gripping. So I would say her. I would also recommend the work of C.J. Cook. A couple of her most recent books, The Lighthouse Witches, has just been optioned and has been made for TV.
Yeah.
So if you like your witches, that's a nice one to go for. That's looking at the Scottish witch trials. But also her most recent one is The Ghost Woods, which again brings in a little bit of Scottish folklore, but also looks at, she calls it feminist Gothic. It's, you know, the mother and baby homes of the 20th century and the impact of that, bringing in some Celtic folklore as well. And I would also say someone who is an absolute powerhouse is Ali Wilkes. She's done quite a lot at the festival. Her work, the most recent book, All the White Spaces, is currently on the Stoker long list for best debut novel, so absolutely worth looking at that. It's an Arctic polar horror with trans characters, so if you're interested in seeing how that that line is held, that's a really good one. But yeah, just so many great writers here. I would say look at the Ghost Story Festival website, see who's been speaking here,
and any of those are
any of them are worth it. Yeah,
I would absolutely agree. And I would say I obviously had the pleasure of interviewing Michelle Paver as Saturday's headline act. Not an interview that I could record to put out, unfortunately, for various reasons, but not Michelle's reasons, just general logistics. But Michelle's ghost stories are a wonderful read. Again, there's a polar one there as well, so very much this sense of isolation. But her most recent from, 2019, I think, wasn't it, Wakenhurst, is one of my favourite reads of this year so far. Mm. It really is a fantastic book and a proper, not only a proper kind of presentation of the Gothic style in all of its formats, but it's so full of good folklore as well.
Absolutely.
So much folklore, so much superstition.
Yeah.
So many old beliefs, but not like here is a list of things that I learned.
Mm.
You know, they are integral to the story, and it's a very good story too. So I'd certainly add those to the list.
And of course, your other interview, Dan Schreiber, on Friday night. Mm. Not a fiction novel necessarily, but if you're into the weird and the wonderful and the strange, absolutely have a look at Dan's work.
Oh yes, absolutely, and do listen to his podcast, because No Such Thing as a Fish, which has only had, like we were saying, just a shade over 400 million downloads.
Just
so
a few.
Only 398 million ahead of this one, you know, but we'll catch up, it's fine.
Absolutely.
Dan was great, and his writing is so entertaining, and the podcast is just bizarre and fun and well worth listening to.
Absolutely.
A good list. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank
it's
you
been
for having
lovely
me.
To talk to you.
Great, thanks so much, Mark.